Today on Straight Talk Africa, a look at what it takes in order to hold free, fair, and credible elections in Africa. Our panelists discuss what it takes for a country to achieve a political and electoral level playing field. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Sheka Sali, and today we are discussing what it takes to hold free, fair, and credible elections in Africa. In 2018, sitting leaders relinquished power in South Africa and Ethiopia. Zimbabwe elected a new leader after 37 years of rule by former President Robert Mugabe. Peaceful power transitions were also observed in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Mali. But while many find those trends encouraging, the opposite is also true in countries where some of the world's longest-serving leaders continue to hold power. VOA's Mariama Jaro has more on this story.
Ethiopia saw unprecedented political change in 2018, says Ruben Brigidi, former U.S. ambassador to the African Union.
The historic decision of former Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn to voluntarily relinquish power is something that's never happened in Ethiopian history before. It paved the way for the entree of the current Prime Minister, Dr. Abiy Ahmed, who has made a series of incredible political reforms, the release of political prisoners, to leading the effort to appoint the first female president in Ethiopia's history.
The second most populous country in Africa also made peace with its neighbor Eritrea after 20 years of hostility. But nearly 1 million people have been displaced in southern Ethiopia since clashes erupted there in April, according to UN agencies. In Zimbabwe, the forced resignation of President Robert Mugabe in late 2017 paved the way for elections this year. Ken Opalo, assistant professor of African politics at Georgetown University.
It wasn't democratic, but it was a transition. And I think any transition is better than no transition, especially if it's done constitutionally, which, ZANU-PF jumped through a lot of hoops to make it look like it was a democratic transition.
The elections were won by President Emmerson Mnangagwa, a longtime ally of Mugabe, making some wonder if this was a real transition from the old guard.
I think, as we're seeing in Mozambique and Angola, any transition is good because the new set of rulers typically want to, be their own men and women. And so they'll implement reforms like you're seeing in Angola that may not always go well with the previous regime.
As the year draws to an end, attention turns to the Democratic Republic of Congo, which will hold elections on December 23rd. Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution in Washington.
If those go passably well, I think this is a huge boost forward, because that will be combined, as I see it, with, not so bad trends in Nigeria, Kenya, Tanzania.
While trends for democracy are encouraging, countries like Congo-Brazzaville, Equatorial Guinea, Cameroon, Sudan, and Uganda are home to some of the longest-serving presidents in Africa. In the case of Equatorial Guinea's president, Theodoro Obiangema Mbasogo, 2019 will mark his 40th year in power. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
For an update on the upcoming elections in the Democratic Republic of Congo, I am joined from Kinshasa by my VOA colleague, Abdurahman Dia. Good evening, Abdu.
Good evening, Shaka.
How are you?
Well, busy. Yeah, that's the least we can say.
Now, give us a sense of the mood on the ground.
Right. I have to say that the atmosphere has basically changed in the last 24 hours, because people were expecting the first last big meeting from a major candidate today. In the middle of the day, we got news that the meeting was not going to happen, because the government said that based on some credible information, there could be trouble. And then a few minutes later, we got that communique from the government basically saying that that all campaign activities from the presidential candidates are suspended, whereas we still have 2 days to go before the end of the campaign. So that's where we are. So I just came from the place where Martin Fayulu was supposed to have his big meeting, with his big rally. People were still there, some very disappointed, but still trying to make the best of it, you know, with a lot of chanting and music and all of that. So that's where we are today.
When you talk to people, and I'm sure you've talked to a lot of people downtown Kinshasa, do you get the sense that people are anxiously waiting to cast their vote? Or is there tension, as some reporters have suggested?
Well, I think you have both. Some people really do want to have a free and fair election and peaceful on Sunday so they can go and cast their ballot. At the same time, there are many who think that anything can happen between now and Sunday. So people are kind of hanging on the thread there. They don't know what's going to happen. And the situation that happened today with this suspension of all campaign activities in Kinshasa just added a little bit more to that kind of a worry that things might not go as smoothly as they were hoping.
Now, most elections in the DRC historically have actually been contested. Do you get the sense, again, when you talk with people that they sincerely feel that at the end of the day, when they cast their vote, that vote is going to count?
Well, I think it depends on who you talk to. And if it's based on the last two elections that were very violent, you know, some people are not very hopeful. They think the same could happen. Others are still hanging on to some hope that, you know, things can go without violence, which doesn't mean that it would go fairly, but it could go without violence depending on how much security there is out there and how determined the opposition is to have a free and fair election. So it's anybody's guess, really.
Now, Abdou, there was a fire reported to have burnt a lot of documents and what have you. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's starting to be a little bit of old news here. The main thing is people are kind of waiting to see if all the material, the electoral material that is supposed to come from Johannesburg is going to be here on time. We know that they were already behind on schedule, and the election commission officials have acknowledged that as well. But they don't know, even if everything gets here in Kinshasa, they don't know how it's going to be dispatched in all parts of the country. It is a big country, and there are about 80,000 polling stations. So that is a big challenge there.
Do we have the sense as to who was behind that fire? Because there have been a lot of people who seem to be pointing fingers to DRC authorities.
It's a pointing finger game. The government is basically naming Martin Fayulu because they are saying that he was the one calling for the destruction of these voting machines. On the other hand, the opposition is suspecting that the authorities may be behind it, so they, going into Sunday, things might be just chaos in Kinshasa, knowing that traditionally Kinshasa is a stronghold of the opposition.
Now, from what you have judged in terms of your interaction and what have you, do you again get the sense that this is an election about certain specific issues, or is it about personalities?
That's a very, very interesting question. If you look at what they are posting on social media, the main candidates, they try to talk about the issues, actually. Infrastructure, security concern in the eastern part of the country and in the Kasai province, as well as unemployment. They all have it out there. Unfortunately, I think it's not getting much attention because of the situation and all those accusations and suspicion going around. So it's hard, really, for everybody to focus on the real issue. But they all have, you know, pretty much programs that showcases hundreds and thousands a lot of money out there to spend, especially on infrastructure and try to develop the country, but it's not getting the attention it is supposed to.
Now, Abdu, you are talking about a country that is incredibly wealthy, and yet people seem to be incredibly poor. Do people talk about some of those apparent contradictions? Why is the Congo very rich, to the extent, in fact, that some scholars at one time characterized it as a geological embarrassment, and yet there's nothing to show for it as far as people are concerned on the ground?
I've been hearing that from a lot of people since I got here, actually. People just don't see why this country is still where it is. And poverty is a reality. I just come from Njili, around the airport area, trying to go back to the downtown area. It is complicated, and people are walking, not having transportation. It's jam, traffic jam. It is really a reality, poverty. And yet, as you said, it is a very rich country. So people do know that. Yes, but that's the reality.
Now, Abdu, again, there was a time when scholars went to the DRC and interviewed people. And people were complaining about this thing called independence. In fact, they were quoted to have said, when is this thing called independence going to come to an end? They were saying that precisely because they said during colonialism, they would find some essential commodities around the corner. But during that time, and we are talking about the 80s, there was nothing really to expect. What are people talking about the politics of the belly, the politics of the stomach?
Well, yeah. And also, the illustration there, I think, is that you have 21 candidates for the presidency. Only three are very visible and basically campaigning around the country. Many of them could find the $100,000 to put down in order to be to have the candidacy accepted, but they are not campaigning. Some are interpreting it as just a way to get attention from the future leaders, the future president. They are hoping that we'll get a ministry or something out of it. But a lot of people are out there saying they are candidates, but no one is seeing them. So that is, in my view, one of the illustrations that, you know, showcase what you're just saying.
What about the people that are in charge of organizing the election? How have they fared so far?
Well, the last couple of days, it's been hard to talk to any of them. I called the rapporteur who promised to call me back because he said he had an urgent issue on his hands, so I don't know what that meant. But the last thing they said was that they were trying to get everything in order that people shouldn't worry, the election should happen and will happen. But there are a lot of issues, and they did acknowledge it, but they are saying that they can make it. So that's the situation.
Do they have confidence in the Electoral Commission's ability, for example, to deliver a free, fair, and credible election at the end of the day?
A lot of opposition supporters are not convinced. Of course, those who are on the other side say that they have nothing to do with it, and it's up to the Election Commission to decide whether they can go ahead with it or not. So they are putting their trust on them. That's the official line. But a lot of opposition supporters are not very convinced.
I know that you have covered several elections in other countries and what have you. From what you have been able to see, what have you been able to learn that you think is very important to share with our audience?
That is hard because the election that I have covered before, mainly Senegal and Mali. Mali was a country that was going through conflict right after the the jihadist insurrection back in 2013. So it was a different situation. Here, they do have conflict in some part of the country, but basically it's not like an invasion in Kinshasa or anything. So there is nothing that could explain, in my view, the fact that they cannot have free and fair elections. So usually instability is used as an excuse. That's what I think.
Well, thank you very much for the good job so far, and do take care of yourself in Kinshasa.
Take care.
You should try and go to Matonge, the cultural epicenter of the Democratic Republic of Congo.
I heard a lot of music, and that was kind of refreshing.
I see.
Given that I've been running around these days.
Yes, that is where people like the late Rwamba, Yamakiyadi, Franco started their career.
I always keep it, charmed despite everything.
Thank you very much. Well, joining us here are three distinguished guests. Elizabeth Lewis, Regional Director for Africa at the Republican Institute here in Washington, D.C. Elias Lukwago, the Lord Mayor of Kampala, the Ugandan capital. And the Reverend Aniedi Okule, Executive Director, Africa Faith and Justice Network. I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you. Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
You're most welcome.
Thank you.
I think it would be important, really, for our audience to know what you actually do at the Republican Institute.
Sure. At the International Republican Institute, we're a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization, and we work to advance democracy around the world. So we support democratic and political institutions, ranging from civil society to political parties, to supporting international election observation and local groups to observe electoral processes as well. So we try to support a dynamic and strong institutions in African countries as well as around the world.
Have you, for example, sent a delegation to the DRC?
While we have a small team in Kinshasa, we do not have an international observation mission in DRC.
Why?
I think in terms of just the resources available, this was not something we were able to do. But we do have a team there, and they're watching the situation closely.
But surely this is a very, very important election. You're talking about probably one of the few countries in the world that actually borders with 9 other countries, a country where, for example, if you talk about any mineral sort of wealth, you name it, you find it mm-hmm. in the DRC. Mm-hmm. When you talk about coltan, that enables us to use iPhones, laptops, and stuff like that, it actually comes from the DRC. Mm-hmm. The DRC also happens in terms of land mass. It happens to be the largest
yes.
country on the continent.
Yes.
Very interesting. What about you, the Lord Mayor of the Ugandan capital, Kampala? First of all, what is Lord Mayor? Because I often hear mayors being referred to as Alderman Mayor. What is the difference between Lord Mayor and Alderman Mayor?
Well, that could be colonial perception, because Alderman is associated with Lordism. But now the new title given to the Lord Mayor of Kampala has no history steeped in those systems, the colonial system. I think it's just a creation of the law without a history. Mm-hmm. But with Alderman, there is a tradition, there is a culture. It's internationally recognized since colonial days. And with this new title, you'll ask those who came up with the new legislation that is governing the legal regime in Kampala. But it has no history. But if you could allow me just to comment on this issue of DRC briefly. IRI, I think they need to take a keen interest, because it's another hotspot. Mm-hmm. Uganda, we are host to so many refugees. There is an influx of refugees from DRC, from South Sudan, from as far as Eritrea, Somalia. So, and ourselves, the country itself is not stable. and because it's like we are also sitting on a time bomb. So there is a catastrophe in waiting within that particular Great Lakes region. So we are worried of the events of 23rd, if they, that poll, I mean that election is not free and fair, and it causes another episode of civil war. I don't know what's going to happen within the region. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the areas where you need to have keen interest, and the international community generally.
Yeah. I agree. It'll be pivotal for the region.
Yeah, sure.
Elections on Sunday.
Are some of your constituents concerned about it?
Oh, yes. It's a very serious matter in Uganda because the refugee crisis is felt by all Ugandans. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and including the city of Kampala.
Including the city, because actually for us it's a double jeopardy, because even when they come to Uganda, they are supposed to be settled in the camps according to the policy. Uganda claims, and indeed, well, it's on record that we have an open door policy to the refugee issue.
Mm.
So once they come, they are supposed to be as a matter of policy, concentrated in the camps. But because of unbearable conditions there, the squalid conditions there, they run away and integrate within communities freely. And in the city, we have no budget to support this influx. And that is a crisis, another crisis.
I see.
Yeah.
What about you, the Reverend Andiedi Okule? The last time I checked, you almost, virtually became a resident analyst here at Straight Talk Africa.
What do I think about?
First of all, what exactly do you do so that the audience can know why you
are? Okay, yes. I'm the executive director of an organization called the Africa Faith and Justice Network, and also a fellow at the Institute for Policy at Catholic University. So at the Africa Faith and Justice Network, we work with lawmakers here on U.S.-Africa policy. But more especially, we engage in the promotion of just governance on the continent of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
By that, we try to build up civil society. We try to remind the people that their leaders are that they employ their leaders and therefore need to hold them accountable. We try to let people understand that governance is more local than national. To quote a distinguished lawmaker here in Washington, who the building there is named after, Tip O'Neill, all politics is local, you know. So that's what we are trying. And we've had a measure of success across the continent.
When you say all politics is local, you remind me of one former U.S. Prominent speaker on Capitol Hill, by the name Tip O'Neill, from Massachusetts.
Yeah.
All politics is local, indeed.
Yes.
What about your particular relationship with the Democratic Republic of Congo? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, in general, what we do is, you know, try to inculcate in the people as much as we can these elements that election, in a special way, is not a one-time act. And prior to that, you mentioned minerals, you mentioned the Eastern DRC. You know, AFJN, the Africa Faith and Justice Network, was among the many organizations who tried to, advance the conflict mineral law that was on Wall Street, you know, Reform Act, specifically because of the DRC, because we saw the suffering there, we saw the looting of the natural resources, we saw the violence against women in the area. We saw how people, you know, living in abundance or sitting on abundance were living in poverty. So we've been particularly concerned about what is going on there and the rule of law that is so much fizzling out.
It's very interesting that you talk about that. But one thing you should also not forget, perhaps, is that in a couple of months, there will also be another huge election in Nigeria.
Absolutely.
And that is a country that you call home.
Yep.
And that is a country that is obviously the most populous nation on the African continent.
That's true. One in five Africans is a Nigerian.
It's very interesting because the last time, in fact, I used to hear one in every four Africans may be a Nigerian. Very interesting. And, of course, the new man who happens to be in charge of U.S.-Africa policy has something to say about that. Nigeria's February 2019 national elections are a critical test, according to Thibaut Nagye, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, who says the conduct of the elections could have significant consequences for the democratic trajectory of Nigeria, West Africa, and indeed the entire continent.
I can tell you from my experience that I fear there will be some violence, as has been the case with previous elections. But I only anticipate localized violence, not nationwide conflict. We are already seeing increased tension as the election approaches, as politicians turn to identity politics to improve their popularity, with potentially serious consequences for national unity. Nigeria has weathered such tensions before, but the U.S. government takes the risk of any loss of life extremely seriously. While in Nigeria, I asked officials from both major parties to sign pledges that their candidates would conduct peaceful campaigns, and both major candidates have now signed such a peace pledge.
You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, so please don't go away because we'll be right back with you.
We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
A reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook, and you can also watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, general elections in the Democratic Republic of Congo are scheduled for December 23rd. The vote will determine a successor to longtime President Joseph Kabila. Several leading opposition figures have been disqualified from the ballot, raising questions about the election's fairness. Unrest persists in eastern Congo, in addition to an Ebola outbreak in North Kivu province. What's at stake in the DRC? On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Today we are discussing what it takes to hold free, fair, and credible elections in Africa. Our guests are Elizabeth Lewis, Regional Director for Africa at the Republican Institute, Elias Lukwago, the Lord Mayor of Kampala, the Ugandan capital, and the Reverend Aniedi Okule, Executive Director, Africa Faith and Justice Network. Let me come to you, Elizabeth. What sense do you have about the election in the DRC? Do you think that is likely to meet the international threshold of being free, fair, and credible?
So I think it's important to remember when we're looking at credibility of election processes that Election Day is just one part of a very long process, a very long and involved process, that it's important that we look at the pre-election environment, Election Day, and then the post-election environment. So things that we take into consideration when we are assessing the credibility of elections are things like, was the campaign space, was it a level playing field for all of the different candidates and political parties that are contesting?
When you talk about a level playing field, what exactly do you mean if you were to talk in a layperson's language?
Sure. So looking at how able are candidates to compete in the electoral process, to campaign across the country. Just on your show a few weeks ago, there was a discussion about the role of opposition political parties. I think that was an important discussion to have. We often find in Africa that the opposition parties are not working on a level playing field. They don't have access to state resources that often are used improperly by ruling party candidates and their political parties to further the campaign. In Zimbabwe, for example, you know, the election in earlier this year was a massive change in the campaign space because the opposition was able to campaign nationwide, but there was a considerable disparity in resources. We look at the media space, so what types of media actors are involved? Are they state-run? Are they private? And are they giving free and fair access to all candidates and covering the issues fairly?
In most countries in Africa, which happen to be democratically challenged, and there are very many, they are not few, incumbent governments tend to hold elections competing against the opposition whose hands are tied behind their backs and their feet tied together. And yet, some of these countries that you come from actually end up endorsing those type of elections. Why?
Well, I mean, I think we just need to continue to look at the full electoral process. We cannot just look at Election Day. And often in Africa, we are seeing that some of the bigger challenges, again, happen in the pre- and post-election period. So in Kenya, for example, it was with the results transmission process that, and then the eventual constitutional court's overruling of the result that was the pivotal piece of that election process. And so it's important that international observers and domestic groups and all stakeholders around following elections, that we look at the full picture of the election process and not just at Election Day.
What about the issue of who constitutes an electoral commission?
That's an important question. And, you know, it's important to look at how they're appointed or selected. If there are certain levels of capacity and technical expertise is certainly important. And, you know, an important role of the election board is to command the trust of the population that they will be able to implement an election that's credible and transparent. And so certainly the selection of election commissioners is a key piece to that.
Elias Rukwago, to what extent do elections, including the one in which you are elected, the Lord Mayor of the Ugandan capital, Kampala, to what extent are those type of elections do meet international thresholds, free, fair, credible, transparent, and verifiable?
Well, when you include the election that returned me as the Lord Mayor, you may prejudice the viewers.
Why?
But if I were to tell you, if I were to tell you what I went through,
you are a very popular guy.
Yes, it was a real nightmare. You know, defeating.
What do you mean by nightmare?
Nightmare because elections in Africa, in Uganda in particular, it's like a battlefield. It's not a civic contest.
It's the moral equivalent of war.
Oh, it's more or less like a war, you know.
Without weapons.
And when, without
the
weapons.
Weapon is on one side.
Exactly. And if you are on the opposition side, you are running against the state. It's not the incumbent as an individual.
So the ruling party, essentially what you are saying is that the ruling party and the state are actually fused.
They are fused, and they are the ones who manage the elections. They are the ones who put in place direct election bodies, the electoral management bodies. And
they are the ones who count the vote.
Who count the votes.
And they are the ones who announce the
results. So in such a situation, it becomes extremely difficult to have a level playing field. My sister here, Elizabeth, is talking about. Actually, African countries have got a template. Elections all over, they are the same. So when you talk about the elections in Uganda in 2016, and all these elections we have had under this regime, actually you can even stretch it to beyond this regime. We have never had a free and fair elections. And this has been certified by the Supreme Court in our case. In all occasions, we have been to court several times with the Colonel Dr. Chizavisije in 2001, 2006, and Mama Mbabazi in 2006, but the verdict has always been the same. And this is the template which is used elsewhere. So what is going to happen in the DRC on 23rd December? It's far from an electoral exercise. Already the signs are there. In DRC, in Nigeria, in February 2019, it's going to be the same story.
You seem to be saying, if I understand you correctly, that elections in most of the African countries which are democratically challenged, frankly, the event is like a couple planning a marriage while concentrating on divorce.
Well, that could be a perfect expression, rather metaphor. That would explain the kind of situation obtaining on the African continent, the kind of electoral processes we are having. Because the rules of the game, ordinarily enshrined in the constitutions and electoral laws of a given country, are never respected.
So why do you keep playing the game?
Of course, you have no choice. The other option would be civil war. Civil war. And that has also got its own ramifications. Why the continent is bleeding right now?
Can't you boycott the process?
Boycott has not been effective, save in a few cases, like in Ghana. I think it was 1994 when Jerry Rawlings attempted to cling on to power to amend the constitution. And I think that one succeeded. But in all these other jurisdictions, these other states, I don't know, I stand to be corrected, where it has been successful.
We just had an incredible election in the island republic of Madagascar. You had an incumbent president organizing an election on his watch, coming in third in that election and conceding defeat. As a matter of fact, as we talk, there is supposed to be a runoff,
yeah,
between two former Madagascan presidents.
Yeah. Those are very isolated cases. Like even in cases where there has been an outright defeat of the incumbents, they have made attempts to cling on. You know the case
like
of Joyce Banda?
The
Gambia, Yaya Jammeh. Yeah. Even Joyce Banda in Malawi tried when she was defeated by Mutharika. And in some other cases, now you've seen people like some African leaders amending the constitution to cling on to power. It's happening in my country, in Uganda. The kind of brutality that is being unleashed on this, on the forces of democracy, on the members of parliament, for example, to stampede them so that they can pass an amendment to allow one person to continue ruling for life. So such situations do not permit free and fair elections. So a person has amended the constitution at the bar of the gun, brutalizing members of the parliament, some of whom now are in wheelchairs. So do you expect him in 2021 to organize a free and fair elections where the chairman electoral commission will announce results that Mr. Yoweri Kaguta Museveni has been freely and democratically defeated by his by his opponents? That cannot happen.
But wait a minute, Elias. Let's face it. There is a saying that when it comes to Uganda in particular, and to a certain degree, its neighbor, the Republic of Rwanda, that you are talking about these individual leaders who are almost virtually what you would call very uniquely gifted, people who could actually be characterized as the best thing that ever happened to those countries politically since sliced bread.
Oh, my God. Do you think any of them can qualify, say, for example, of the award of the Mo Ibrahim Prize? Those ones?
None
can qualify.
Your president, at least according to Mo Ibrahim, I've had him on Straight Talk Africa, and he told me that President Yoweri Museveni said he really does not care about the Mo Ibrahim Prize because he is not poor.
You see, you've got to understand the dynamics pushing him to say that. He is one person who has ruled the country for the last 33 years. He has monopolized all the state institutions.
But he says that he is ruling the country precisely because Ugandans love him and they think that he is the only one, really, who can be in charge of that store. Without him, the country could possibly collapse.
And actually, that is the crisis we are facing, not only in Uganda, but the entire African continent. This strongman syndrome, as opposed to the democratic processes. And that's the reason we are appealing to the international community to have some kind of change of paradigm, change of perception, change of their policy towards Uganda and most of these African countries. Because now they have actually over-glorified Mr. Yoweri Museveni to be the alpha and omega, to be the only group holding the entire region together, that actually is indispensable. Without him, the entire Great Lakes region would go up in flames. So he's the one who is the expert on South Sudan issues, the expert on DRC matters, the one who is handling the conflict in Burundi, the one who is saying, yes, I'm the one now responsible for the semblance of peace there is
Somalia.
In Somalia and elsewhere. So that is not synonymous with a sustainable democratic system.
We'll come back to that later. You're tuned into Straight Talk Africa. To participate in our conversation, call us at 202-619-3111. And the U.S. country code is 1. We'll continue our discussion in a moment, so please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them, today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies.
Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known.
It's Upfront every Wednesday, 1730 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
If you like today's show, please write and tell us what you think or give us some suggestions. Be sure to tell us what station you're tuned into. Our address, Straight Talk Africa, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or send us an email at africatv@voanews.com. Log on to our website at voaafrica.com. Or post your comments on Facebook, keywords Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui Ewart. And of course, this is Straight Talk Africa, coming to you live from Washington. Let me come to you, the Reverend Anyedi Okule. Something huge, hugely positive happened in Nigeria about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Was it about 5 years ago?
About four years ago. Yeah.
We're talking about 2015.
Yes.
You had an incumbent president.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
For the first time in the history of your country, organize and lose an election and concede defeat with grace.
Yep.
You also equally had an incredibly unique chairman of the Independent National Electoral Commission, Professor Atahiri Muhammadu Jega. He did an incredible job, something that they thought could never be done in Nigeria.
Yeah.
What should we expect in February in Nigeria?
I think we should expect the same.
Really?
I think, you know, the 2015 election was just, it defied all odds. In fact, I had attended a meeting in this town where people were discussing, quote, the dissolution of Nigeria, you know, as the 2015 election was approaching. I'm talking about people, analysts, who thought that Nigeria is finished.
Yes.
Yeah, but then the Nigeria beat all odds, you know. There was election. The incumbent lost. He acknowledged and receded to the background. And we had a new president, still have a new president. Although the atmosphere has changed somewhat, the dynamics are still there, namely the agitation among the electorate, saying, well, we put in a new government in place. We expected the new government to do X, Y, Z, and it's not happening the way we expected. So there's an agitation that there's going to be change. However, the current government also has strong supporters who said, look, they need another 4 years to complete the promises they made to the people.
So, especially the fight against corruption.
Especially the fight against corruption, yes.
The problems of Boko Haram?
Yeah, you know, that's where I'm coming, that because the corruption was one thing, the other was security. While there are inroads into corruption, security situation has deteriorated far worse than it was in 2015. Let me explain. You know, in 2015, there was Boko Haram really active in the Northeast. Now, 3 years later, you have Boko Haram re-emerging, even though there was suppression initially after the government came into power. Boko Haram has re-emerged and diffused into other areas. You have the issue of the herdsmen clashing with the farmers. You have the issue of Kano, Nnamdi Kanu, agitating for Biafra. And you have other elements that the kidnappers are getting stronger. So the issue of security has become a big challenge to the country. And the hope that the present president, who has been a military general, the hope that he would, with his skills, would surmount all of this, has not really happened the way people expected.
But he actually tried.
Pardon?
He actually tried. He seems to have reasonably, I think, done better than the previous one.
He tried.
But there was a time when he actually addressed a press conference and declared that Boko Haram had actually been technically defeated.
Yes.
What happened?
Well, you know, a press conference is one thing, that the reality is another. You know, because when that happens, they wasn't totally certified. I mean, they just pushed back Boko Haram out of the cities, you know, Maiduguri and the surrounding, but they didn't go into the Bisak forest to contain them. So they regrouped and came back, and they spill over to Cameroon and Niger and, you know, and Chad, you know. So we see that happening. So for me, as I look at it, it was a premature declaration of victory.
Is it possible that we actually understand the fundamental root causes of Boko Haram? And if we did, isn't it possible, frankly, that we could address that? Because it seems to me that the fight, frankly, is just about symptoms.
It's symptoms. Actually, you touch on something crucial. If you can indulge me for 1 minute, see, Boko Haram didn't start to attack government. Boko Haram started as a reform movement within Islam. And what was their grievances? Grievances that, you know, we have all these educated people and they're corrupting the nation. So why go to school? Boko Haram literally means Western education is an abomination.
Right.
It's forbidden. Mm. And so they tried gathering people who were sympathetic to Muhammad Yusuf, who was their leader. And at one point, he had about 250,000 followers. And so the person running for state election, the governor candidate, tapped into that, recruited them to do campaign, I will change things for you, you know. And one neglected them. So they started saying, hey, wait a minute, how come? That's when they started attacking government institutions. And then it spiraled when they became violent. At one point, the president sent in the military to go and quell it down. They did. They took the leader, captured him, handed over to the police. And he mysteriously died in police custody. So the followers then went berserk. But fundamental to the symptoms you are talking about is the symptom of the lack of engagement of a large population of youth in Nigeria in general, but in the north in particular. And what is responsible for that? There's this idea of, I give my firstborn to a Muslim leader to train. And you have a lot of young men who never went to school, who follow this leader, and who are uneducated, and so they can't enter into the workforce. So they become susceptible
to... They have no skills
to enter into the workforce, and so they become agents of... They become easily targets by these fanatics.
Poverty,
and even with politicians...
The desperate
politicians recruit them to attack people during elections and after elections. So there is a fundamental issue that needs to be addressed that is cultural, the whole idea of the feudal system in the northern part of Nigeria, where a kind of, if I may borrow a term from former President Reagan, trickle-down economics, you know, that is there, that the chiefs are the one who dish out things fall from the rich man's table and they eat.
Others used to call it trickle-down blood.
Yes. Until we address that, the problem will continue no matter whom you elect president. Because there is something very fundamental in that part of the country that makes young men unqualified to enter the workforce and make them susceptible to being recruited, radicalized, and used as talks to attack civilian targets.
What about allegations that, in fact, there were even some military or security elements essentially working together with Boko Haram?
You know, that has been said. Actually, former President Goodluck Jonathan said openly that there are even people within his government who are, quote, sympathetic to Boko Haram, and there are things to believe. I mean, to say there is some truth to this. Namely, sometimes there's a secret operation to go and target Boko Haram targets. And before they are there, Boko Haram knows they are coming. How does that happen? Or sometimes the ambush that happens with the military.
And the type of weapons
and that, the type of weapons they have. So Boko Haram is really not just a ragtag army.
I see.
You know, it's well-sponsored, well-coordinated, and there are informants within high level that, you know, that supply them information and weapons to destabilize what is going on.
Time is not a best ally. Let me go to Elizabeth for some kind of foreign aid, really. What do you really think needs to happen in order for Africa seriously to begin holding elections and not selections?
Mm. Well, I think one key element to that is having an informed citizenry that is able to first understand the options available to them, what
civic
their
education.
Rights are. Exactly, precisely. Elections are important in that people are going to make an informed decision at the ballot box. And without the materials and information to be able to do that, that is a challenge. It's also important that they feel the ability to safely go and cast their vote, which speaks to some of the security conversation we've been having. And then finally, that they can vote their conscience in secret, and that that there won't be retribution or even the threat of retribution against them. And that is also key in elections in Africa, and was a particular challenge we were looking at in Zimbabwe.
Very interesting. Someone has suggested that part of the problem in Africa with regards to not holding free, fair elections is precisely the same point that Elizabeth is making, which is, in those people's view, that Africa lacks people who are citizens owing allegiance to the state and having constitutional rights and actually being the primary stakeholders in their countries, looking at presidents, looking at mayors like you as their employees, basically. Rather, that a lot of Africans really today are subjects owing allegiance to individual authorities. They could be presidential monarchs, they could be the Kabaka, they could be kings, monarchies, or whatever, do not have constitutional rights, or at least they don't think they have really power over those people who actually rule them and sort of disguise that they are governing them, but in fact they are rulers, not leaders. How do we get to the point of people having unfettered access to civic education that is sufficient enough to make them realize the power that they have so they can assert it?
Well, personally, I don't want to look at it as civic education per se, but it's empowerment of the people, civic empowerment. Because right now, many countries experience that crisis where the citizenry is devoid of power. They don't have the authority. This thing of the sovereignty of the people are just fictions within their national constitutions. In the case of Uganda, for example, our president did not mince words. He just told Ugandans off. I'm not your servant. He said, I'm not your servant. So you can imagine.
Is it true that he also said that he actually works for his children and his grandchildren?
Basically, that is the notion under informing decisions.
Then what is he doing in the State House?
That's a question every Ugandan is asking. So the situation right now, you find, like, for example, in our case in Uganda, the citizenry is on one side, and is pitted against government. And there is a clash now. And today, you would find people fighting against the state, and rather the government in power. The government is also exerting force, repression, and oppression.
I hate to say it, but unfortunately, there's no democracy in Studio 47. When the producer says you have to go, you have to go, like a loyal soldier. Sure. Well, on that note, thanks to our distinguished guests, Elizabeth Lewis, Elias Lukwago, and the Reverend Aniedi Okule. Thank you all for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.